Welcome to Lexis, the podcast all about language and linguistics. I'm Lisa Casey.
I'm Jackie Glancy.
I'm Raj Rana.
And I'm Dan Clayton. So on this episode of Lexis, we're really pleased to welcome Tim Marr and Steve Collins, who are authors of Language Awareness at School, A Practical Guide for Teachers and School Leaders. Steve is Head of English at Bishop Luffer School in Chichester, and Tim is Visiting Professor at Isesi University, which is in Cali, Colombia. It's quite exotic, isn't it?
It is quite, actually, yeah.
I mean, Chichester's nice.
Chichester's nice, but Cal has hummingbird and parrots.
And I was going to say, Middlesbrough's lovely as well, Dan.
Okay. Right, okay. So, first question is about, well, I mean, lots of the questions are linked to the book, and it is a very good book. I think lots and lots of English teachers and teachers more generally will find it useful. But in your book, you lay out a number of reasons why language teaching, and this is not just English language teaching, is important to all school pupils and students. So why is the teaching of language so important to each of you as individuals? And what is it in your own backgrounds and your work that's led to this, you know, interest in and love of language?
Well, if I can go first, I mean, looking back, I always liked reading. I was good at writing. So languages came fairly naturally to me. But there was this one pivotal experience that I had, which I think informed all my later thinking about language. And it was that I went to a fairly rough primary school in West Yorkshire. And then when I went to grammar school at the age of 11, it was a bit of a shock to the system. And I think I probably had a slightly stronger local accent than most of the other children there. Not all of them, but certainly some of them. But the point is, there was this one teacher who had a go at me in my first few months there. And I don't think he liked me, frankly, and I certainly didn't like him. But he took me aside and said, "Ma, why do you have to talk in that horrible, sloppy, I forget the exact words he used, but ugly, sloppy kind of way?" And I didn't really know how to defend myself. In fact, I couldn't defend myself, and I found it quite irritating, but I also found it quite embarrassing. It was very difficult to experience. And then some years later, I mean, I always liked languages, so I went on to read modern languages and linguistics at university. And then in linguistics, I suddenly came across sociolinguistics, and it was like a light going on in my head. And I thought, I wish I'd known all this stuff those sort of 7 or 8 years ago when Mr. X said what he said. And then I would have had the tools to defend myself, because I knew what he was saying was wrong, and I knew it was unfair, and I knew it was unreasonable. But I didn't know how, I didn't know why, and I didn't know how to, defend myself against this. So I think that always stuck with me. And then later on, as I got into a career in sort of teaching and university teaching and writing about language, I always wanted to spread this awareness of how language works and why it's so important to know how language works.
Yeah. So this was a school in West Yorkshire.
I'm tiptoeing carefully around the actual name of it, but it was a grammar school in West Yorkshire, and the teacher in question had a pretty strong West Yorkshire accent himself, but he still thought it reasonable to attack my way of speaking.
Right.
And I repeat, I was 11 at the time. Yeah. I wasn't quite as thick-skinned then as I am now.
I think a lot of people have a similar experience when they...
I think so.
I think that particularly around that kind of age when you're a bit more conscious of your language and your language is changing as you develop your own sense of identity. But it's quite a kind of cruel moment to experience, isn't it?
I was going to say, I think he just didn't like me, and he wanted to attack me for some reason. But it's odd that he picked on that to attack me, and it kind of worked. It really knocked me off balance, and I couldn't say why it knocked me off balance, but I knew it was wrong. I knew it was wrong, but I just couldn't say why.
Yeah. And what about you, Steve? What were your sort of formative influences with language?
Well, I suppose after university, I wanted to do a bit of travelling. So I went to Peru, and actually that's where Tim and I met. And teaching English as a foreign language. And that was the first time that I became aware, really, how the English language works. Because we weren't really taught, I mean, I went to a grammar school as well, but we weren't really taught consciously about language at school. And after that, you know, I've worked in the travel industry and in journalism. So I've been aware of the use of language my whole working life. But when I became a teacher, and it perhaps because I haven't got an English literature degree, I've got a social science degree, I became conscious of the fact that language per se isn't really studied. The focus is more on literature than language. And most teachers, in fact, most English teachers are literature specialists rather than language specialists. So, I feel that it's something that I was very conscious of, and I wanted to try and redress that balance. Really, that's the area that I most enjoy, the language aspect of the GCSEs, Key Stage 3 and Key Stage 4 and 5.
Yeah.
And I think it very much depends, doesn't it, on the age at which you were at school? Because, I mean, I think we're all kind of around the same age. And it was, you know, it's definitely my experience going through school. It was very light touch in terms of any knowledge about language. And mine only came really when I went to university and studied language and literature. And, you know, that it came as quite a shock that, you know, there was these, you know, all of this knowledge that I'd never really considered before and then became very useful, you know, in my own teaching. We'll have to get people to guess our ages from
the competition. We'll do that as a competition.
Competition.
We'll offer a signed copy of the book if they can get them all right. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
The subscription to Sopka.
Half price copy, perhaps. let's not go mad here. Yeah.
We do seem to go in cycles where we cover perhaps the same arguments again and again, in, you know, decade after decade. And language teaching is certainly no exception to that. So we've had grammar wars in the 1930s, the 1980s, and more recently, 2010s, and debates about the role of English teaching, you know, forever. So what do you see as the state of play now? And what would you say the position of English language teaching is in at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, you're right about the fact that these grammar wars have been going on forever. It's absolutely extraordinary when you look back at the history of it. And I like to collect old books about language and linguistics. And I got a lovely old first edition of a book by M.A.K. Halliday from 1961. And almost the first thing he said was, we really need to have much more linguistically informed teaching of grammar in schools. But this book was substantially older than I am. And this argument was going on even then. And as you say, it was happening even in the 1930s. So I would like to be optimistic, but to be brutally frank, I'm not sure how optimistic we can be. The bright spots that I do see is that there seems to be a more kind of organized push at the moment for better, more linguistically informed teaching of grammar. And it's good to see organizations of university linguistics departments getting involved in the debate around grammar and standard English at schools. And I think social media has probably helped to unite people, and it makes it easier The obvious thing to say, though, about university linguistics departments is that many of them are under threat at the moment. Yeah. The latest one I saw just the other day was University of Kent is talking about closing down its linguistics. So it's difficult to see where the push can come from. And to some extent, I think it seems hard to shovel the responsibility over to English teachers themselves. However, I think they do need to pick up some of the responsibility to be part of the movement, part of the conversation, and really get stuck into serious teaching of grammar, properly linguistically informed teaching of grammar. But I mean, Steve can probably talk more about how he sees it on the situation on the ground.
Yeah, yes, it's quite interesting you mentioned those periods, because I think they were periods of sort of, you know, like an ideology imposition on standard language. Hopefully we're at the end of one of those periods now. I mean, what upsets me, 25 years ago, I thought we were getting somewhere with, you know, you had the Key Stage 4 spoken language assessment. Speaking and listening was then a part of the GCSE, and they were both removed, and I think they were removed for ideological reasons. So yeah, we've taken a step back. I mean, the chinks of light, A-level language, you know, I don't know what the latest statistics are. I think there has been a decline over the years with lit, lang, and lang and lit.
Yeah.
I think they're sort of flattening out a bit, I hope anyway. And there's growing awareness at Key Stage 3. I think the EMC Language Lab book is a good example of how to get children in engaged in the language they speak. I understand just on a couple of days that an oracy commission has been set up, speaking and listening. So hopefully, you know, that might be something positive coming out of that.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And I think that's going to be chaired by Jeff Barton, who's an ex-English teacher and was head of the head teachers union, wasn't he? Mm. And he's quite known for, and in, you know, he's had a long interest in language teaching in school. So that seems good. And also Rob Drummond's on involved in that as well. Yeah. So that's very positive.
That's a good sign. Yeah. We were just saying to each other this morning that we were reading about this and we thought, that's a good sign that if you've got somebody like Rob Drummond on this committee, then at least there's a... At least the conversation, you know, that the conversation will just not be just shut down immediately.
Yes.
Going somewhere.
I mean, it's interesting as well when you say about oracy, because I mean, Ian Cushing's written about this recently, about the sort of roots of the term and some of the research on it. And it's, you know, lots of the discussion around it is really interesting. I mean, there's clearly, you know, lots of people are very much in favour of oracy. And I think a lot of English teachers see the real need for students to be, you know, orally fluent and conscious of language that they're using, but there's also, it's got its roots in maybe more kind of prescriptive, you know, deficit ideologies as well. So it's about sort of that balance, isn't it? And treading that fine line. So it'd be interesting to see what they do, but I mean, I'm much more hopeful of that commission than many of the ones in previous years.
Let's
say for the sake of argument since 2010, whichever reason. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it just without being sort of too doom-mongery, I mean, it does feel like we're at a, hopefully reaching the sort of bottom of a kind of downward spiral at the moment, because we've got, you know, numbers at A level have been down, as you say, you know, since 2013-14, which is sort of peak of English A level numbers, they've gone down a huge number. We've got, you know, university departments, as you say, struggling to recruit, is difficulties recruiting English teacher trainees, you know, that's not a positive sign. And there's also doesn't seem much of an appetite for students at GCSE to really want to go on and do English at A level. So what can be done about this? And you know, what would you say are some things that could be done to change that?
I think there's a connection between all of the things you mentioned. I mean, I think the GCSE, when it was reformed, I think the first time that the new exams was sat was in 2017. And we saw a dip in take-up of A-level, I think because the GCSE was regarded as difficult, but also not that interesting, to be perfectly honest. At the same time, we saw the loss of the AS level, and that was quite a good way of introducing students to the basics of English language or English literature, English language literature. I mean, most of the time they carried on, but I think after doing a year of it, it was always a good way of keeping students involved in the A levels. Yeah, they already had a qualification. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to a time when there will be more speaking and listening. There'll be a return to coursework. I might be being very idealistic there, but I think, you know, when I was teaching then, you know, we had full classes of English literature and English language and literature. So there's definitely been a downturn. Also, university fees. I think, you know, there's been a focus on STEM subject, which has had an effect on English language and English lit take up.
Yeah, yeah.
Sometimes you look at parts of the curriculum and you just think, well, it just doesn't look very attractive. As we said before, we appear to be hopefully at the end of at the very bottom of a period where English has been presented in this very rigid way in terms of everything has to be standardized and only standard grammar is acceptable. And, you know, if I was 15 and thinking about what subject I would like to do, I probably wouldn't be that turned on by English, I don't think. It really needs a bit of a PR makeover. If English was presented as being not just about writing correctly and so on, but about the way we use language, the way we speak, if children could be persuaded that it actually engaged with the way that they speak and why they speak like that and why their parents speak the way they do and why they speak to their friends in a different way than they would speak to their teachers, if all of this was up for discussion and analysis in the classroom, and the English classroom does seem to me to be the natural site for conversations of that nature. If all of that was part of the subject that we call English, I think it would be a much more attractive proposition than it is at the moment.
And it has been, I think it has been in the past, hasn't it? I mean, I think it has been
much more so in the past. And all of that bit of it seems to have just been drained away. Mm.
And there was real engagement with the, I think it was called the spoken word, the last time it was in the GCSE specification. And students were looking at transcripts and looking at, you know, authentic speech. And I think there was real engagement there and real interest. I think for some teachers, it was challenging because it was something that they hadn't experienced or had knowledge of, especially, as you say, maybe coming from literature backgrounds. But I think, it was a welcome addition to the specification from the point of view of the students.
Yeah.
I mean, you could have a whole focus on how spokenness is differs from writtenness, why it differs, and in what ways or in what context spokenness and writtenness overlap, like, for example, in text messages or whatever. All of that stuff would be very exciting and engaging, I think, to students. But
at the moment, it's
not very visible.
I think as well in the book, you do talk a bit about that, don't you? In that sense that there's lots of misapprehensions about the nature of language and the assumption that written forms are the kind of, you know, the right ones. And there's a kind of little anecdote, or that's not the right word, is it? What is it? There's a kind of there's a little case study there, isn't there? Is it about Justin Bieber? And the student who writes Justin Bieber a letter complaining about his grammar because he hasn't used the subjunctive. And you kind of think,
if I were your boyfriend or something,
And I mean, it's that sort of misunderstanding, isn't it, about how we actually communicate in speech and which forms are more appropriate to writing. Yeah. If we just have some early discussions about that, you'd have a much better idea about what language does and what it can, you know.
We said when we included that about Justin Bieber, we said the problem is if you confuse speech and writing and you assume that the standard is always correct and so on, that, and we said, I forget the exact phrase, but we said something like if you teach children like that, then you don't produce sensitive communicators, you produce pedants.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we don't produce linguistically sensitive, careful communicators. We produce pedants.
Thank you.
Reading from this excellent... Oh, it's the book. No, exactly.
So what would your response be to, you know, some of the typical responses that you might see on Twitter when you suggest that, you know, we look at authentic speech and texting and things like that? You know, there's sometimes a bit of an uproar and an accusation that we're dumbing down the subject. What would your responses be to those kind of anxieties?
Well, I mean, I think the first obvious thing to say is that you wouldn't only look at non-standard forms. You would look at standard forms and non-standard forms, and you would compare the two and you would analyze the two. And that's what we would call a language-aware approach to thinking about standardness and non-standardness. It's not possible for a student to understand what the standard language is if they don't understand what non-standard language is. And I can't understand why these phrases, why these perfectly simple, accessible terms from linguistics are not used systematically in the English language classroom. I mean, I know some teachers use this kind of language, but many don't. And it seems to me strange because these are the tools that help us to understand how language works.
What kind of terminology do you think would be really important for, let's say, kind of like emerging teachers coming into the profession? What kind of terminology do you think would be the basics that would be helpful for?
I think you could talk about the basic terminology of sociolinguistics, like the difference between correctness and standardness, the definition of a dialect, the definition of accent, making clear what standard English is and what it isn't, a critical, informed approach to things like sociolects and ethnolects. These are basic terms which could be taught in a couple of hours in a teacher training course without any problem at all.
Well, one of the things I do in school is I talk to the PGCEs and the trainees. One of the standards they have to keep and address is the whole idea about literacy across the curriculum. And I think, you know, we've made a little sort of an amendment to that statement. Every teacher's a literacy teacher, and we put in every teacher's a language and literacy teacher, and I try and sort of emphasize that. But that's just done in my school, and, you know, we talk about that in the book. But I mean, I think if we could see that being proposed nationally, That would be a great idea. And as Tim says, you know, it would only be a couple of hours, wouldn't it?
It really would. Towards the end of the book, we lay out a kind of stall of what we would like to see in initial teacher training from a linguistics point of view. And mm-hmm. I think there we say, you know, it would be lovely to have a whole module about language and the school. All right, we accept that's probably never going to happen. But to be honest, you could really open some minds and change some minds with a one-day session on language and the school. Yeah. I would love to teach something like that on a PGCE course. But if you ever speak to PGCE tutors about things like that, they say, oh, we haven't got time for that. Well, how can you not have time for language?
Yeah, their sense is it's like packed already, isn't it? I mean, I've gone and done a few things with PGCE tutors at a couple of universities where we've done like a 2 or 3 hour session on language and arguments about language, the issues around standard English and things like that. And it feels like it should be embedded more than just get some guy in to talk about it and bang on about it again.
Yeah, no, I'm glad that at least you're doing that. Anything is better than nothing. But yes, this kind of language awareness should be absolutely embedded. Yeah.
You also sort of argue for language awareness across the curriculum, don't you? The whole curriculum, not just English. So why is that important?
I'll start and then you've got
five. Go ahead.
You know, communication is a fundamental part of every single subject. And we don't just use English for the sake of it. Although I think sometimes kids do think that. But we use it to get what we want done. And if we want to be effective in this, we need to know what we are doing and how language works and what people really mean. And I think that's even more important today with the influence of social media and AI as well. And, you know, and I think there are attempts to address language use, but they can be a little bit misguided. You know, there are posters in different classrooms telling students what to write in, say, design, technology, history, and biology. I see that, but they're not really thinking why they need to use certain words, phrases, or grammatical structures. And I'd like to see a little bit more of that.
Yeah, I mean, in the book, we reproduce a poster. It's called the EAP something. I forget what, but it produces, I suppose, call them educational resources for schools. And there's this poster that's been distributed in schools. I don't know how widely, to be honest, but it's certainly been distributed in some measure in schools. And the example we have of this poster, it's from it's history, isn't it? And it says it's presented as do and don't. Yeah. And it says, do use formal vocabulary, don't use phrasal verbs. I made a note of it. So where was it? Yes, avoid rhetorical questions. So there is kind of language advice out there for disciplines across the curriculum, history, science, geography, whatever it might be. But how much of that advice is actually good, solid advice built on solid linguistic foundations? I mean, to be as kind as I possibly can be to the poster about history. It's clunky, it's mechanical, it's highly prescriptive. I mean, you know, to take the example of a two-word verb or a phrasal verb, as we would call it, why would you not use phrasal? If a phrasal verb fits, then use a phrasal verb. Why would you not? And if a rhetorical question seems to fit the context of an essay in history, then use a rhetorical question. I can't see any reason why you wouldn't.
Yeah.
So I do worry about the lack of language awareness in general, and people who are not language specialists. And again, we go back to the fact that there is very, very little about language in teacher training in the PGCE, for example. We get back to this idea that a science teacher or a non-language specialist, whatever they may be, may think that this advice is marvelous advice, and they put the posters up on the wall, and they tell the children not to use phrasal verbs and to use a long Latinate verb instead. And this is unnuanced, highly prescriptive advice, which is not coming from any kind of language awareness perspective. And I think that's one reason why we would argue for a properly language aware approach right across the school.
I'm just thinking, I think that sometimes the problem does come down to time again, because curriculums are so packed, increasingly so, that it is a shortcut, isn't it? If you can trim it down to a do this, don't do that, you can get a message across quickly. But as you say, you're losing the nuance. So you're losing the why. Why would it be more appropriate to use language in this way, in this context? And, or why would it be less appropriate to use language in this way, in this context? And that discussion, I think, is perhaps what's missing. But I think there are perhaps two reasons for that. As you say, the lack of language training for ITTs, but then also the time pressures once you're in schools to get through the content.
And I think the other, maybe a sort of a other angle to it as well, is, like you say, the kind of tick list, sort of rather dogmatic, rigid approach is quite kind of easy. It seems to sort of, you know, that lends itself to, okay, we've only got a few minutes to do this, so have this.
We're doing literacy in our subject.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, with the history stuff.
Yeah.
I was listening to Alice Roberts on the radio this morning, and you kind of think, well, you know, the book she writes about history, and, you know, other good books about history, which are accessible and readable, consist of lots of phrasal verbs, lots of rhetorical questions. Yeah. The clarity in the writing comes from actually thinking about your audience and thinking about what you're trying to communicate, rather than this sort of set of, you know, stupid rules about whether it's kind of grammar rules or, you know, particular ones about using this sort of higher quality vocabulary, which seems to have sort of embedded itself in so much teaching at the moment. You know, it's just actually just go for something that's a bit more cogent. Go for something that's, you know, that makes sense rather than something that sounds a bit fancy and sounds more academic. I think, I'm sure Jackie's seen this as well, but lots of the writing that we see from students who are trying very, very hard to sound academic makes absolutely no sense. And what you need is just something that actually communicates a kind of basic level.
One of the examples of the earlier on in the book, I got an email from a sixth form tutor, and I got an email from another sixth form tutor who sent me a message saying, oh, this student applying for a university, and in his personal statement, he talks about, during my D of E qualification, I learned how to ameliorate my map reading skills, you know, well done, you know. So just, you know, if you can find a sort of a, you know, a Latinate multisyllabic word, then chuck it in there and you'll sound really clever. Or not, yes. And we talk about the as a Friends episode where Joey, you know, uses a thesaurus to write a statement about the appropriateness of his friends to have a child, adopt a child, and it's hilarious.
He replaces every word with a more complicated word from the thesaurus. So we call this the Joey from Friends effect.
You
think you're going to sound more clever and sophisticated, but actually you end up sounding like Joey from Friends.
Yeah. I have to find a link to that to include in the show notes so people can watch that bit of the episode.
Good, yeah.
So you also argue that deficit views and zero tolerance approaches to standard English aren't helpful. So could you give us some examples and then how you would approach these issues differently? What would you do instead?
You're right. This is an extremely important area, and it's quite a hot topic at the moment. It's been rumbling on for a few years now, and we begin the book with this. We're not the only people to notice this. Other people have written about it, but we still thought it would be a good thing to start with actual examples from schools where they've attempted to ban certain words or phrases. Or they've taken what they call a zero tolerance approach to against certain words, phrases, or features of speech. And it seems a rather extraordinary thing, because the basis of linguistic knowledge upon which these kind of strictures seem to be founded is almost always non-existent. And typically they talk about banning slang, and then they include lists of what they call slang. And some of this is what we might call slang. Some of it is purely local dialectal usage. Mm-hmm. Some of it is perfectly normal, colloquial, low register standard English. Yep. Some of it is again, perfectly normal hedges and fillers like and like, and so on. And basically, I mean, you imagine a school banning the word basically to start an utterance,
and also pronunciation as well, isn't it? That, you know,
that's another thing. It's not even local dialect; it's just simply local pronunciation. And here we go back to again the lack of awareness of the difference between spokenness and writtenness. They're approaching spoken text as if it was the same as written text, and followed the same rules, and it simply doesn't. We all know that. And I think, again, we had a snappy phrase that we worked on for hours in the book, and it's something like these, the people who produce these lists, the head teachers of these academy schools, we say they typically show a great concern for language, but no genuine interest in language.
Mm.
And it seems to be a one-size-fits-all approach. We've decided that these words are unacceptable, and we're not going to argue about it. We're not going to discuss it. We're not going to use it as a learning opportunity about language. We're not going to use it as a way of comparing normal everyday speech with more formal speech. We're going to throw all of those learning opportunities away, and we're just going to say, you're not allowed to use your own perfectly normal speech in the classroom.
And enough is replaced with things like tiered language. You know, that's a way of understanding language. And that doesn't allow for any creativity that exists in either written or spoken language. Yeah, we all of us mix registers. Yeah, that's part of the beauty of any language. And, you know, deficit is not, usually not a deficit at all. I mean, I think, yeah, some children, yeah, they do have a less active vocabulary than other children. But, you know, everybody can communicate, and schools and exams are demanding children communicate in a more societally valued way. That's reasonable, but, you know, it should be done without making a child feel that their language is not as good as somebody else's, or there's something wrong with the way they speak or the way their friends or their parents speak.
Yeah, I mean, this goes to the heart of what we would call a properly language aware approach to teaching. That we have no objection to the teaching of standard English, and we think that children should be taught to use standard English. We see no problem with that at all. However, it should be done in a language aware way, a constructive way, a sympathetic way, and a critical way. Children need to understand what standard English is and what it isn't. It's a more societally valued way in some contexts of speaking and writing, but it doesn't mean it's better than any other kind of speaking or writing. It doesn't mean there's anything wrong with a child's language or the language that they use with their friends. It's always a question of context
and a register. You know, when is the right time to use a particular code, and when isn't, and maybe not the appropriate time to use that code.
Yeah,
that's what we think is language approach.
The argument I often see sort of leveled against that in various places tends to be the sort of common sense view, if you like, in scare quotes, that essentially that's okay if you are a kind of liberal, middle class, white, well-educated, you know, university adjacent teacher or professional. But for the vast majority of young people who don't have rich language environments in the home, that they need to be taught to use standard English in ways that, you know, might appear a little bit prescriptive, but it's all for the good of social justice, you know, that these things are put into play, and that, you know, those rules are just guidelines. Zero tolerance is just a phrase. You descriptivist liberals, you're getting your kind of knickers in a twist a bit about this. And actually, you know, your enemies of promise is standing in the way of education. I'll stop there because I was getting too much into my role-playing role of...
You really believe this stuff, Dan, don't you?
Yeah.
Absolutely. I've been radicalised by GB News.
Silence in those corridors now as well.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I think, as I say, we don't have any problem with teaching standard English at all. We're perfectly happy with the teaching of standard English. And the world, we're not trying to change the world. With the world as it is, we accept that children need to be taught standard English. However, that can be done in a language-aware, critical, properly linguistically informed manner by teachers who are sensitive to matters of language. There is no reason on earth why you have to impose standard English in a prescriptive way. It's what you do is you incorporate standard English as part of a wider discussion about language and context, and as Steve says, register. And of course, actually, Jackie, you were asking earlier on about what terms would we ideally have in that all teachers will be conversant with. Register is another one.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, there's no earthly reason why standard English has to be, the teaching of standard English has to be approached in a prescriptive way. It doesn't. It can be done in a comparative, linguistically informed way.
Okay. Well, if we go into the quick fire ones.
Yeah, fine.
Given that there's two of you, we're being generous and we're saying you're allowed one each to these.
Thank
we're
you.
Not asking you to have a hive mind on this. So yeah. First one is, what's your favourite book about language? So let me go to Steve first on this.
Well, I was thinking about how in the classroom, books, which are fictional books, which deal with language. So anything from Alex Weakle to Peter Carey, The True History of the Kelly Gang, Anthony Burgess, Clockwork Orange. Mm. I think that they would be a great, Clockwork Orange is one of my favourite novels, but they would be a great way in to looking at how language works, whether it's in fiction or in reality. Yeah. So yeah, and Ridley Walker as well. Mm.
We're both massive Anthony Burgess fans. He of course used to, apart from being a fine novelist, he used to teach linguistics himself. So we like everything about Anthony Burgess. He had a very, just before he died, he produced a very nice little book called A Mouthful of Air, which is a popular introduction to linguistics, but written with Anthony Burgess's particular flair
and what a great title!
A mouthful. It is a great title. However, I'm not going to pick that for my quick pick. I'm going to go for Guy Deutscher, The Unfolding of Language. Fabulous book,
right?
And I'll say no more about it because it's supposed to be a quick fire questions. But I heartily recommend it.
Yeah. Given between you chose six books there, and we could have two, but we'll cut you off. Right.
Okay, so what's your favourite linguistic fact or idea?
Halliday says, to make a child feel ashamed of the way he speaks is as bad as making them feel ashamed about the colour of his skin.
He said that some years ago, and it's never stopped being true. I'll go for a different one, but a related one. It's not exactly my favourite fact, so I'm stretching a point here, but it's an extremely important fact. That something like 20% of all the world's existing languages will die out before the end of this century. And that's something like 1,500 languages lost forever. And we're very strongly in favour of valuing the way people speak. So we value people's language and we think schools should value students' language. But we also think languages should be valued and people should be doing more to try and preserve these endangered languages. Because once they're gone forever.
We were did an interview with Emily M. Bender, who's a professor of computational linguistics in the US earlier in the week. And she's got a rule named after her, the Bender rule, which is that if you talk about a language, you need to specify which language you're talking about. Because the assumption often is, among lots of people, it's English. And of course, English is not the only language around the world, is it? Yeah, English is actually taking away lots of languages around the world. But that's a conversation for another day, maybe. Right, so finally, what one bit of advice would you give a budding linguist?
Herbert Pocket in Great Expectations says, look about you. I'm looking about me, Pip. And I think that's it. Notice things. Yeah, notice. Become a language noticer. See the language around you. Take note of, why are things written in a particular way? Why did this person say that in a particular way or pronounce something in a certain way?
Yeah, that's mine as well. Yeah. In the first book I wrote, it was called With Fiona English, which was called Why Do Linguistics? That's what we said. You need to become a noticer of language. That's the first step. Right. Listen to what people say. Think about why they say it that way. Notice how things are written and think about why they're written that way and so on.
Great stuff. I hadn't clicked. That was you and Fiona English. That's a really good book. Sorry, I didn't realise that you'd written that. It's good.
That's very kind of you. Thank you.
No, well, thanks very much. And I mean, I think we'd definitely recommend language awareness at school to all English teachers generally, but also, as Jackie was suggesting, with sort of PGCE students and trainers, but and teachers more generally, as you say, literacy and language awareness shouldn't just be for English teachers. It's there's lots of really accessible stuff in it. It's a really good read, and I'm glad you've written it.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Jackie.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. Thank you, Jackie.
Been great to talk to you both.